On today's podcast, author Garth Jones is back to talk about his new book, Homebrewed Vampire Bullets. My name is Justin Hamilton, and you're listening to Big Squid Presents Pass the Ammo. Thanks for joining me for our latest episode of Pass the Ammo. This time we're looking at Garth's work with his new book, Homebrewed Vampire Bullets. If you've enjoyed these episodes where we've been digging right into the exploitation genre, and I've really enjoyed it as well, I've learned a lot from this segment, you would have a blast with his crazy novel. Like, it's insane. And in this interview, we're going to talk broadly about the love of the genre, the influences, and where some of the story goes without giving away too much of the plot. I don't know if I could give away too much of the plot. There's so much going on. But rather than me describe the book for you, this clip I'm about to play, which was originally created as a pitch read, I think it kind of sums it up nicely. So have a listen to this.
Remember when Aussies could take the piss out of ourselves? Someone needs to get a laugh out of the apocalypse. Let's go. Homebrewed Vampire Bullets takes place in a parallel Australia. Think Wake in Fright meets Dogs in Space meets Howling 3. It's 2016 and we're a republic. Ed Von Satan is the Barry McKenzie of pub rock, zombified by a bunyip. He hits the road with a girl band called Babylon. Turns out the gig's a ritual to summon the World Blaster, an interdimensional bastard who harvests planets for fuel. Homebrewed's a crazy road narrative, a mongrel punk beast embracing political satire, horror, knockabout black comedy, and a dimension-hopping psychedelic war story to boot. Homebrew speaks to our current state. We're led by morons, assailed by crises in every direction. Into that mix are flung a seedy cast of miscreants, lunatics, and demagogues. The fate of everything is at stake, and we're going to need a pretty good laugh at this dumb planet's apocalypse.
This is a fun book with lots of twists and turns, and it's got a Baroque Aussie language that just permeates every page, and it has a crazy over-the-top aesthetic. There are also QR codes littered throughout the book that when you click on them, take you to some musical scores that have been created by Half Majesty. Have a little listen to this little grab of music. This will give you a bit of a flavour of the music that's out there that accompanies this work. That's great, right? Like, just kind of the perfect mood. And especially when you pair it with the book, it really adds a texture to the reading experience. I'll play you a second grab just before the interview. But if you'd like to check out more of that music, it's created by Half Majesty. And Half Majesty can be found on Twitter at Half Majesty. Or you can check out their whole score for the book at halfmajesty.bandcamp.com. So what I'll do is I'll just play a little more of that music, and from there we will segue into Garth, and then I'll come back to have a quick chat with you about the rest of the week at the end of this podcast.
Thank you.
classic podcast form, we started talking and I thought, fuck it, let's start recording before we waste any of this. You were talking about The Sandman on Netflix, which at this point, and this podcast will be coming out in September, so I'll be finished by then, but at this point, I've watched the first three episodes, and the third episode had Joanna Constantine in it. Not Constantine, Constantine.
Constantine, everyone should know that by now.
Everyone should know that by now.
It's only been 40 years.
It's amazing how people are still angry about it. It seems to be... people are just as angry about it being pronounced Constantine as they are about their favourite fictional character not being a white cis male.
Yes. I'm going to be really upset with this. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was... I have to be honest, I've really quite enjoyed it. I think it's... the first episode is really strange because it's so faithful to the comic, which is great.
Yeah,
but as a first episode of television, it's very weird because your protagonist doesn't do anything except pretty much sit in a glass bowl for three quarters of the entirety
of the show. Yeah,
it's a very strange way to start a TV series, but it made sense as a comic.
I mean, that's from the books. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much beat for beat as the original comic was. I mean, I came to the. I got the graphic novel maybe when it came out.
Right,
the first collection. Was my introduction to it, and then I got through it. Sandman at uni, they had like the bound editions because it was already finished by then.
Yep.
It's not fresh in my mind, but you know, it was at a very sort of formative time where everything in the show is like adapted very faithfully.
Yep.
I mean, my big beef was Hell episode three?
No, that's episode four. That's the next one.
I haven't seen that, right? Anyway, yeah, I think it's just mainly aesthetic choices that I've got issues with.
Right.
You know, they've done the casting of Dream's great. I think the casting across the board's great. But I've just got production design issues that sort of take me out of it. And as I was saying before we started recording, we're currently in Brisbane in a short-term rental while we get our life together here again.
Yeah.
I think the TV we've got is just very average when it comes to projecting digital stuff.
Right.
Everything looks cheap and like a 3D model.
Okay. Yeah, I get that.
So that cools me out a bit, yeah.
I have to be honest and say that my expectations have always been pretty low, not even from any other aspect or perspective other than how do you create The Sandman, which is pretty early on, a very DC... influenced
in the universe.
Comic. You know, you've got the Martian Manhunter turning up, you've got There's John Constantine.
Yeah,
you've got so much stuff that is tied into DC cosmology. I was always a bit curious as to how they would kind of extricate that part of it when they were doing it as a series or a movie.
Yes.
I'm glad it's a series because I think as a movie...
Our film would be terrible. Yeah.
You just wouldn't be able to... get enough of what makes it wonderful in there, and in the process, you'd be left. You know, they'd strip mine all of that, and then you'd just end up with a standard movie. And
well, without spoiling anything, and you'll have seen it by the time this comes out for anyone who's probably cares. They do have there are nods later in the season to like the DC universe, but you know, in a very winking oblique sense.
Yeah.
And we know Neil Gaiman sort of. Come out and said that it exists in all the you know the universes all interrelate.
Yeah,
I think he said on Twitter.
Yeah,
and there's like, did you listen to him on Marin?
No, maybe? I can't do Marin anymore.
That really brought me back to the Gaiman fold though, because like you know that was a delightful interview.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because he's had some bad press recently in some senses.
Right.
But yeah, really great if you can stomach it.
That's
maybe I'll do an edit for you.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, if you could just give me his answers, that'd be fine. You know, he's been so hands on with it, and sometimes that's a bad thing. You know, it can be a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing. I weirdly, even though I love the Book of Good Omens and actually have a signed copy from Neil Gaiman, I couldn't get past the 15-minute mark with that. And I don't know if it was my mood or maybe my tastes have just changed, but there was just something that wasn't quite connecting with me. So I went into this with, I wouldn't say low expectations, but kind of no expectations. And I've been enjoying it. Like I haven't felt an urge to churn through it, but when it's suddenly like, oh, okay, because at the moment I'm watching a lot of quality television. Mm. You know, I've got For All Mankind, I think On This Date is finishing today, their third season. That's been great. Better Call Saul has been a masterpiece. Westworld has been a complete return to form and has been great. What We Do in the Shadows is as funny as ever. And so when you've got all of these things, it feels like it's the next rung down, but it's not the next rung down like you're shitting on it. It's just that there's real quality happening, and then you watch this and you go, oh, this is quite good. And I think it's kind of easy to, like, I know someone who thought it was dog shit, and anyone who listens to this podcast knows that by using the term dog shit, I am quite clearly referring to Ben Elwood. But I think you have to divorce yourself from your expectations. Like, to be honest, in the second episode, I thought the depiction of Kane wasn't how I had him in my head. And the way I've had him in my head is from the Alan Moore Swamp Thing era.
Oh, yes. Yep.
I had him very much more acerbic and a lot more always kind of a bit aggro. And in this, he was kind of, in this episode anyway, he was a bit more buffoonery.
Yeah, there is an aspect of tweeness to a lot of the characterizations that sort of do come from the books as well. as a product of something that came out in the late 80s, early 90s, and then to faithfully reproduce it in 2022 with a lot of that stuff still in place.
Yeah.
If your head's not there, it can feel anachronistic to a degree.
Yeah, yeah. And I think they've said that they're trying to, their approach has been to, as if they are creating it in modern times. So, but, you know, there's still a bit of that. Without giving too much away, the thing about Lucifer, which I have not been able to pick up from, I haven't watched much in the way of trailers. I think she looks wonderful. But one of the things that I was a bit worried about with Lucifer is he's really funny. And is he funny? Is Lucifer funny in this?
It's more of a glorified cameo. I mean,
is it? Okay.
We're sort of setting up for like the season of mists.
Right.
It's the episode sort of takes some twists away from the comic, but not as acerbic.
Right.
You know, obviously there's a full range of people out there who are going to be upset that it's a woman, but you know, she's really formidable. And yeah, we know what's coming, so we just have to sort of wait and see. Yeah,
yeah, it's a little bit more like planting the seed for future seasons. I thought I was always a fan of Jenna Coleman in Doctor Who, and she was saddled with a kind of a weird character where we were told she was important. Her character
another character I think we'll see later on.
Yeah, and I thought she was really good.
I'll say that. Yeah, I think it sets up. it's a really solid foundation.
Yeah.
For what's to come.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they're going to get the opportunity.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've taken that swing. They've done that range of genres. You know, some of it to my taste, they could have been as extreme as the books and gotten away with it, considering the format, but they have sort of sanitized a little bit of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was. I still saw some pretty violent scenes in that third episode with Thewlis. So, you know, it's a hard needle to thread, but. I'm glad it's out there, and I'm enjoying it. So I'd prefer that it's good and people then go and find the graphic novels and...
go through the entire experience.
Yeah, definitely.
But I'll say the Hob Gadling episode is probably one of the most fun ones.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so that's a real laugh, and it sets up a lot of good stuff as well.
Okay, great. All right. Yeah. And before we get into your work, have you seen Prey?
Yes.
I thought that was my main criticism with Prey was that I was watching it at home. I would have been wrapped if I paid money to see that.
Fantastic. Yeah, that was perfect. My major takeaway was like, why didn't you release this in a cinema?
Oh, unbelievable, right? Like, it would have looked phenomenal.
shit TV aside, it also sort of, yeah, you know, lent it that sheen that sort of takes me away from it. But yeah, like, just what an excellent reimagining. And the design of the alien, the design of the Predator was just, you know, next level as well.
Yeah.
The performances were, fantastic.
Yeah. Did you ever watch Legion?
Yes. Yeah.
I thought she was great on that as well. So.
Yeah. I mean, my expectations were pretty high and they were equaled, if not exceeded.
I've never, I like the original Predator film, and then to be honest, I don't really care about Predator. So, but I saw the premise and I saw it was Amber Midthunder and I saw the first image and I thought, oh, that all looks quite tasty. I'll give it a go. And it was fantastic.
I was at the pub with a mate on last Friday night when it came out, and I actually said to me, oh shit, Prey's out. I got to go home.
Yeah. Did he understand? Did he get it?
He didn't understand. He'll get there.
Yeah.
But it's a top three Predator film now. You know, I think it's probably the second best one. I do have a soft spot for Predator 2 because I had the Dark Horse comics when they were when I couldn't watch the movie.
Back in the day, they were quite good. The Dark Horse kind of knew what they were doing. They've always been quite good.
There was actually there was one that was drawn by Evan Dorkin. That actually was set on an Indian reservation. It was like an army base. Situation. It's like a Navajo guy takes on the Predator in the current day. So yeah, they set up a lot of the concepts. In the '90s, like lots of good stuff. But
Dark Horse underrated with a licensed character.
Yes. Did you ever see the Predator, the Shane Black?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nah. Yeah. Enough said.
It was an interesting experience, that film.
Yes. Yeah, I think they've made the right decision here by going back to the, you know, the roots of the characters and just...
And once you take credits out, 90 minutes. Or, you know, if you sit to the end of the, you know, the little illustrations, 92 minutes, you know, and doesn't waste any time.
Yep, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Everyone watch it.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I did not get in touch with Garth to talk about other people's work. We are actually here to talk about his work. He has released the first volume of Homebrewed Vampire Bullets. And I guess...
It'll be up for pre-orders when this comes out, I think.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. That's cool. So this is coming out early September.
This is cool. The book comes out on Halloween, the first volume.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All good. So... before we kind of get into the book, what was your introduction to the exploitation genre? Because we kind of talked about it, but and you know your tastes, etc. But what was the first piece of that genre that you came across and appealed to you?
Well, I grew up in Broken Hill in Western New South Wales. In the first memories are sort of the early 80s, where we lived across the road from a roo shooter.
Yeah,
who'd come home every day with a ute load of headless kangaroos and park across the road.
Right.
Just as we were going out to get the bus to school in the morning.
Right.
So, you know, the environment that I grew up in was like, it felt like we're on a film set, and it was sort of innate to your understanding by the time you were sort of like 7 or 8 that actually you are on a film set, because Mad Max, Razorback, Mad Max 2, you know, all these like seminal exploitation flicks are being made in the backyard. I mean, I think I might have seen some of the set from Mad Max 2 when I was very young in Silverton.
Right,
But never, I didn't see Mad Max until I was only 20, I think. But the first one I remember is Razorback because of that roo shooting parallel. And I think that might have been a VHS that I wasn't allowed to watch for a long time, but, poverted down at the Video Vision around the corner.
Yeah.
Just that sense of landscape and, being in that environment really sort of set the mind off, because, you know, when you're a kid growing up pre-internet in the middle of nowhere and all your culture comes via 2 channels on TV and what's at the video store.
Yeah.
It sort of gets immersive and, you know, that's your understanding of the world.
Yeah. Razorback was my introduction to that world as well. And I could be remembering this mildly incorrectly, but I did see it at the cinema. Yeah. And I reckon Mum won tickets to the Anne Wills preview. So it was actually a mainstream. Yeah. It was a mainstream movie back then.
Yeah. That's crazy, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so to have it kind of you know, shift into this umbrella of Ausbilitation is such a funny thing to me because it was marketed as Australia's Jaws.
Australian Jaws, yeah.
Yeah. And Russell Mulcahy at that point was a well-known director for all of his Duran Duran and Elton John film videos, clips. Yeah.
And then off to do Highlander.
Yeah.
Pretty soon after that.
Yeah.
I'm fairly sure that's the introduction. And then it was, you know, we just sort of, existed in that bubble and it didn't really come back to it until I started working with Umbrella Entertainment and working on all those titles and actually getting a chance to go through and actually, bathe myself in all the lunacy.
Yeah. And is that part of the appeal is it kind of reminds you of where you grew up? Is that kind of the innate way that you got in, or was there something about the storytelling that appealed?
I think at the very, very sort of primal level, it's definitely a connection to that landscape and environment that a lot of these things are made in. I still crave desert heat and, you know, red dirt.
Yeah.
Although we've been in Auckland for 6 months and it's been rain and rain and more rain. Then the stories, you know, the sort of, the transgression, the sort of no holds barred aspects of a lot of these things where they were just like, well, fuck it, let's just go and do it.
Yeah.
And like, you know, someone might die.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Tarantino says that he coined the term Ausbilitation. Is that correct?
I think it's, this is from Mark Hartley's Not Quite Hollywood, isn't it? Where he's discussing it. I mean, it was the Australian New Wave was what it was called.
Right.
At the time, it was sort of like that, like Spielberg and Lucas and De Palma and all the rest going to school together, school together. Because basically there was, after World War II, we had no film industry, which was probably good because a lot of the films before World War II were just super racist.
Right. And,
yeah. I mean, there's a guy called Charles Chauvel who did like a whole bunch of films about, you know, settlers falling in love with natives, and I'm doing air quotes here, and lots of that sort of gear. So it was probably good that our film industry died for 25 years or so.
But it was
the Whitlam and Gorton governments that started funding film school and film projects again in the early 70s. And it was called the Australian New Wave. And I guess there's, you know, parallel tiers. There's the sort of stuff that became Ausbilitation, and then there's the sort of highbrow stuff like Picnic and Hanging Rock.
Yeah.
And the stuff that actually had ideas and was investigating our relationship to the past and our identity and not just having boobs and big, you know, V8s and all the rest.
Yeah. And somehow some of those movies combining both.
Yeah. Yeah.
So funny.
That's the secret. Yeah. The secret sauce, isn't it?
Like, yeah.
Can you get both?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, the ingredients of your typical Ausbilitation story is sex, horror, and action. And these are quite clearly topics that have had critics turning their noses up for a long time. I feel like that's changing a little bit in the current climate. Like, people aren't as dismissive of genre anymore.
Yeah. I think film and television, sure.
Yeah.
I think absolutely. Like, we're sort of, you know, streaming and prestige television and sort of, you know, the variety of choice is sort of greater these days. And, you know, there's something for everyone. But in the world of letters, I don't know that this attitude's the same.
Right.
Not surprised. This project I started 4 years ago and it started going out and getting shortlisted for things in 2020.
Right.
If we remember that very short, enjoyable year that was.
Yeah. A hell of a 6 weeks.
Totally good one. Yeah. But a big shout out here to the Queensland Writers Centre who have been really, really supportive of the project. But once you get in front of Australian publishers, the tastes are more rarefied. They're not looking for gear that, you know, tracks in the vernacular or any generic elements, I guess, is what you... how you'd phrase it.
It seems like you have to probably make it a hit for them to then take you on board rather than the other way around.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And I mean, these books, I had a specific vision for how they'd be presented, and no one would do that without a track record anyway.
Right, of course.
This is not going to happen. So yeah, I think definitely film and television projects, but there's not much adventure out there in the literary world.
Yeah. What are they looking for?
Tim Winton?
Yeah.
G'day, Tim.
Yeah, not his fault.
No, but you need to stick to your lane, and like you've got one genre that you can do at a time.
Yeah.
And you can't lean into sort of the more grotesque aspects of like, you know, Australian culture, or, you know, hang shit on people that might be in their worlds as sort of, you know, as these books progress, I get a bit shirty with, you know, the art world and things like that.
Right.
I just think there's not a real taste for it's also, you know, again, like there's a whole variety of voices out there that definitely need to be heard, but
yeah,
I've got the luxury of being able to start my own imprint.
Yeah.
And just do it myself.
Yeah.
And it's heaps of fun anyway. So
yeah. At least you get to control it as well. Well, so I want to talk about this first volume, and I'm going to talk a little bit obliquely so I don't give too much away. But we follow very early on in the story the band Toxic Shock. I need to point out for everyone, Toxic Shock is spelled TOXXIKSHOKK. And that pretty much sums up the band. They are...
Two umlauts.
Yep, absolutely. Yes, sorry for leaving that out. They're a sad band still kind of living the dream in their heads. And I was wondering, where did the inspiration for the band come from? Was it from a specific kind of band that you'd ever seen, or was it a number of bands you've seen over the years?
It might come as a surprise to you, but I was the only kid in year eight that was wearing cowboy boots and pirate blouses to the band.
Amazing.
The shows that we were seeing at the time.
Right, yeah.
At the YWCA, they would have things called band frenzies.
Right.
That I'd draw the posters for, and that would be some pretty great renderings of either chicks in bikinis, barbarians with chicks in bikinis.
Yep.
Or chicks in bikinis with skulls and barbarians.
Oh, yeah, great.
All the tropes.
Yep.
And the band frenzies were, like, pretty regular, and we'd have... all the teen bands, Butterfunky Rubber Soup, all the local teen bands, I should say. So you can guess who they were influenced by, can't you?
Yeah.
Dungeon, Fury, The Figs.
Yeah.
They're all people roughly our age. And I have a distinct memory of one night at the local civic centre after a couple of these bands were on, this bunch of dudes in their 40s and 50s with, like, grey beards and, like, the cowboy hats and all the rest came up, and they were called Potbelly Burning.
Right.
And they sort of did, like, old school blues rock.
Yeah.
To a bunch of teenagers in, like, you know, Reebok pumps. Not me, obviously, but the other ones. You know, hockey jerseys and all the rest. And I was just like, that stuck in my memory. I was like, well, what, you know, those guys are lifers.
Yeah.
Turning up to, like, you know, have 50 kids see them and just be bewildered by what the hell they were doing.
Right.
It wasn't Rage Against the Machine inspired rap rock. It wasn't. Yep. Red Hot Chili Peppers inspired stuff, and it wasn't like Metallica inspired stuff. And that sort of, I think that was the genesis. It was just these dudes that are just still out there plugging away.
Yeah.
And then over the years, I've gotten more and more, you know, you see photos of people from, like, you know, bands that you'd like in the 80s and 90s, and you're just like, holy shit, you're still out there playing to, like, a, you know, a festival crowd in the US.
Right.
At midday. You're still living the dream.
They are, aren't they? Like, they still are living the dream.
Yeah, to some extent, I guess. I mean, it must be pseudo depressing to be, like, putting the banner up and, like, you know, going through the motions.
Yeah.
But there's something delusional and sort of, like, romantic about it as well.
Well, maybe it's not depressing. Maybe they're having a really good time.
I'm in fucking Warrant. Yeah.
Like, there's a possibility, you know? Yeah. It's I don't know. Like, maybe I'm projecting how I'd feel, but I would definitely feel like, oh no, maybe it's time to give this away, but they must be still getting something out of it. And I feel like the band in the book are still true believers, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They're doing their poppers and, like, you know, driving their shitty old Bedford from small, thinly veiled town to small, thinly veiled town.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I was one thing also, years later, my partner Anna, we were talking about the book, and she turns to me and says, I had a punk band called Toxic Shock Syndrome.
Oh, really?
At university.
Yeah.
And these guys, I think I might have come up with it in Adelaide, like in right. sort of, you know, early 2000s. So yeah, parallels.
It's funny.
Isn't it?
When your daughter gets older, when yeah. did you realise that you guys were perfect for each other? Well, it all comes down to toxic shock.
Here's my photos, and here's daddy's like thinly veiled autobiography.
Yeah, hilarious. Yeah. The story veers pretty wildly between the past and the present, which I think gives it a cinematic feel. It feels like it's bouncing back and forth between like two channels. And was this part of the plan when you first began writing it, or was this something that kind of just naturally fell into place?
I can hear the Edgar Wright sort of whip pan sound effects now when I read it.
Yes, yes.
Like the sort of tonal shifts and sort of narrative, you know, tributaries and like, you know, U-turns and all the rest. At the time I started the project, this is like 2018, I properly got into gear with it.
Yeah.
And we found out we were going to have a little girl in October. So I sat down the day after we'd gotten the news and I made a flowchart of yep. the plot, which had been sort of gestating for years and years, but I'd just been too busy doing all the stuff in the book.
Right.
To actually get around to writing the book.
Yeah.
And so I made a flowchart of the plot that I then challenged myself to write one segment a day.
Yep.
And see where it went. And then over the course of the last 3.5 years with yeah. like revisions, you know, beta readers, feedback, all the rest, it's been reconfigured into where it's ended up now.
Okay. And,
you know, it didn't actually start with the Bunyip segment initially.
Right.
That was further back in the book as sort of a reveal. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that slowly started to make sense. And I also, wrote another 10,000 words late last year while it was in competition for a publishable prize.
Right, right. That's interesting to me because I feel like and we'll talk about the Bunyip in a second, but it feels incredibly part of the genre to have that happen so early on.
Yes, yeah. I thought we needed to, because then, you know, it's not necessarily a horror story.
No.
But I thought it was a fun place to start it in that action. And yeah. sort of also the mundanity of these guys and their sort of the flashbacks to, you know, their shit teenage.
Yeah.
Sort of their beginnings.
Yeah. It's like you're discovering their origins while finding out
that they're about to go. Yeah.
They're in a lot of trouble at this yeah. precise moment.
A hell of a lot of trouble. Yeah.
How'd you go with the beta readers, and can you explain that to people who might not know what that term is?
Beta readers are people who come in and read your manuscript and sort of make suggestions that you're not necessarily tied to,
yeah.
but think that will help you sort of punch up what you've got and yeah. get it to a point where you can actually, you know, present it to publishers.
Yeah. And did you find it helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. I was working with a guy called Josh Donnellan, who's a writer here in Brisbane.
Yep.
And he was really helpful. Just, you know, the there's a band called Babylon, which is an all-girl punk band yeah. in the story. And, you know, the first volume is pretty dude heavy. And yeah. I plant the seeds of like how important they become as we go through the book.
Yes.
Through the narrative, which is really important because it's essentially a story about, you know, delusional blokes who are past their prime, who need to get out of the way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the first volume can come on a bit strong in the sense of it just being these, you know, the guys who are still living their dream at, you know, 50.
Right.
And so, yeah, Josh's suggestion was great. And I sort of moved some of the stuff around Babylon around and added more at that yeah. point. And, yeah, it does feel more like we're seeding things now in the first volume.
Yeah, great.
Rather than just, like, being hit over the head with bad behaviour.
Yeah, right. What was the weirdest advice that you got?
Weirdest.
Did anyone just kind of miss the point?
One of the discussions we had, I've asked heaps of people if, like, it was, if, you know, the language is too much or if, in terms of, like, using the Australian, you know, the vernacular.
Yeah.
If it's hard to get past, as, you know, I've asked friends in America to read it, you know, can you understand it even?
Yeah.
I had worries about the vernacular, worry, concerns about whether whether the changes in the time frames were too confusing.
Yeah.
Just ironing that sort of thing out.
Yeah. It is kind of dense in the sense of all the vernacular that you use, especially even I'm across it and it's still having to get into the rhythm, but it's a little bit like reading anything that has a specific point of view, which is, you know, it's like you read the first couple of pages of A Clockwork Orange and you think, how the fuck am I going to get through
this?
And then by the end, you've worked out the rhythm of it. And I think that's what happens with this. It's like the first probably the first few chapters, I was like, okay, let's get into this. And then I'd put it down and then I'd do something else. And then I'd get back into it. And then eventually it just kind of clicks. And then you kind of can follow it really quite easily, I think.
Yeah. I can't remember. Someone did say, you know, mention like Irvine Welsh, not that I'm making any comparison whatsoever to myself, but you know, like just the sort of, you know, once you're into sort of the rhythm of the language.
Yeah.
It does, make more sense.
Yeah. I think it's quite easy to follow. But you just have to unlock it, and once you do, you'll be there. You've already brought up the Bunyip, and it's interesting, the original Bunyip myth, which I have to be honest, I kind of knew that the Bunyip had been scary, and originally it was a man-eating monster that lived in rivers, lakes, and swamps, and used to hunt women and children to eat. And then by the 1800s, which I thought was quite interesting, it had changed to being a plant eater and was a friendly creature in children's books, and it also became an insult, meaning imposter. How did that happen? Like, why did the Bunyip myth get kind of turned into something that was lovable, and what inspired you to bring the Bunyip back to its roots?
You think it was the early settlers just going like, well, you can't have your fairy, you can't have your myth, your scary myth. We'll just completely castrate it from the outset.
Yeah.
Because like indigenous people in Australia have so many cool monsters. That, like you check out Wikipedia and like there's at the top, there's Drop Bear in terms of Australian monsters. You're like, no, fuck that.
Yeah.
But then there's some fascinating, you know, myths and creatures that have like not really been heavily sort of exposed in popular culture, I guess.
Yeah.
I grew up going on lots of road trips, obviously, because we're in the middle of, you know, far western New South Wales. And the Murray River, which is the river that sort of goes through the top of Victoria into South Australia, where it becomes the River Murray, is sort of the home of the Bunyip myth. Legend. Yep. And it was sort of, you know, top of mind as a kid, where a lot of these ideas probably sort of just got locked for a long time. You know, it was familiar to me as like something that would eat you if you went into a swamp.
Yeah.
I don't think I had much, you know, understanding of any of the sort of changes in how the Bunyip had been perceived since.
Yeah.
And we had like on those drives, you know, the Min Min lights, which is like a sort of visual phenomenon that looks like a UFO following the car on a late night drive.
Right.
And, you know, driving along the Murray, you know, the sort of the Bunyip terror, all that stuff just really sort of, embedded deeply in the subconscious.
Yeah.
And then I went back and researched it lightly because I wanted to sort of just make it into my predator to jump back a bit. But I also added the kink of having the capable of turning people into zombies so he could have revenge on the colonial settlers.
Yeah.
And just murder some white people.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, yeah.
The Australian outback and Australia in general has this great capacity to easily blend sci-fi and the occult, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's just tailor-made for it, and I'm surprised that it doesn't happen anywhere near as much as it should.
Yeah.
I mean, as a side note, I did pitch this as a TV adaptation or film adaptation, thanks to Queensland Writers Centre again.
Right.
In May 2020, just when, so again, not much appetite for something of this style, you know, style and tone, especially in the middle of a pandemic where you can't shoot anything.
Yeah. It would make a crazy fucking movie.
And I was listening. I've got a script. I've got a spec script of the first chapter.
Yeah, I'm ready to go.
It's ready to go.
Tell me more about
casting.
Good luck making sure that you get that power as well. I look forward to you being having furious conversations with you when they've got the wrong person.
Ruined it all, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me more about Ed Von Satan, the kind of almost the lead.
Semi-protagonist.
Yeah. He's a funny character.
He is the Barry McKenzie of rock and roll, I guess.
Yeah. You might have to explain Barry McKenzie for people overseas.
Yeah, that was in the one of the pictures I did. Barry McKenzie is like a character from the early 70s who's a lecherous, Australian stereotype of that era.
Yeah.
Who bombed around a bunch of films. And
yeah.
Yeah. There were sort of the sexploitation films, I guess, to some extent too.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's like Jack Thompson in double denim with a haircut from the Saints.
Yeah.
The Aussie punk band. He's every overconfident mind bloke I grew up around.
Yeah.
Who have that gleam in their eye, but are just essentially a bit shit.
Yeah.
Just irreverent, uncouth, and permanently wasted. And he's also an actual rock and roll zombie.
Yeah.
He has an encounter with the Bunyip, but he's got some mystical protection. That I'll leave as a surprise to the reader.
Yeah, it's funny the way that comes about as well. He's a funny character. Like, you kind of are rooting for him.
He just keeps failing, but, you know, he fails into interesting places. And, I think there's a monograph at the start of the book, which is just a random tweet I saw, which is relating to characters as boring, being a voyeur to a bunch of sickos and dirtbags. That's good fiction.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the mission statement in reverse for this, I guess.
Yeah. I was kind of picturing not necessarily looking like him, but an uncouth version of Kurt Russell in Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, I was going to say there's an aspect of Jack Burton there too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the kind of useless guy that still seems to be moving forward while everything else is falling apart around him.
All my friends are going to have been zombified. I'm going to get the hell out of here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
unbeknownst to me, my pseudo-girlfriend is the one actually resolving this.
Yeah, sorting this all out. Mm. The story is dialed up to the max with some hilarious jokes, lots of jokes in there and funny turns of phrases. Were there any ideas that you felt were too much or at least needed a bit more time to marinate before you unleashed them on the world?
I guess the first draft of this, to some extent, started 10 years before I started writing the book.
Yeah.
Around 2008. And all those ideas were awful, self-conscious, edgelord style attempts at writing gonzo fiction.
Right.
So I've spared everyone all of that by coming back and finding a voice that I can actually call my own, I guess.
Yeah.
And, so that draft has been deleted from every possible, place that could have been saved over the last 15 years.
Yeah. You have to get that out there though. Do you know what I mean?
I just remember the document that it was sitting in and going through it one day. I was like, no, you can take the names that you've written. The names you've come up with are good.
Yeah.
The character names are cool. Everything else is going to, be completely incinerated.
But that's all right.
You just say, you need to know.
Yeah.
And make that decision and not embarrass yourself too much. But the first volume's a bit of a, it's not sanitized or easy read, but things get more scatological and naughtier as things progress, I guess.
Yeah.
I didn't think I did trim a few things that were probably more just around language that 6 years ago would have been fine, but I'm talking about when I wrote one of the short stories for this in 2016. Just stuff that didn't play as well now.
Yeah.
Taken out of context, you'd be, self-cancelling, I guess.
Right. Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? So I caught up with comedian Mickey D last night. I haven't seen Mickey for a while. And he has a photographic memory for pretty much everyone's career that he's been entwined with in the past, two plus decades.
Yeah.
And we were discussing, how things have moved in stand-up for better or worse, mainly for better, I think. And he was just bringing up turns of phrases or throwaway jokes or references that when I was hearing them, I was equal parts hysterically laughing and also having to go outside and breathe into a paper bag they were just terms or topics that were fine, like were genuinely fine. And even though you were approaching them from a satirical point of view, out of context now, if someone,
cut and taste that bit and my God.
Lord, it's just too hard. Like you'd just be spending a lot of time.
It's nerve wracking. So yeah, I think that were the main, there's nothing in terms of raunch language, violence or like concepts that I really got rid of. Things I looked at, you know, yeah, just with a bit of like more of a sensitive eye.
Yeah.
Because, you know, also the dude who wrote this 4 years ago is now a dad of a nearly four-year-old. And a lot of stuff's changed. So,
yeah.
I'm like, flash forward to her potentially reading this.
Well, that's funny.
You know, give a little bit of a polish to this.
Yeah. Well, that's the Steven Spielberg story about Close Encounters, because we're going to be – that. This might already have been up by the time this podcast is released, but that was going to be our first Space Odyssey. So I rewatched that and did some research. And, you know, at the end of that, Richard Dreyfuss leaves his family behind and gets on a UFO. And Spielberg said, I wrote that before I had a family.
Yeah.
That's not how that movie ends now.
I'm going with the aliens.
Yeah.
So yeah, and that's you know, as I said, like the band Babylon definitely has been punched up a lot thanks to that. For notes and just like, you know, sort of balancing the narrative out into a something. Because, you know, part of my ethos, I guess, the genre I put this in for like hashtag purpose and all the rest is mongrel punk.
Right.
And, you know, which sort of covers the gamut of the occult, the sex, drugs, rock and roll, all the rest.
Yeah.
But, sorry, I lost my thread.
But you were just talking about, you know, punching up the story and making sure you know, even though it's a parody with these guys, you're evening it out.
So I always thought, oh, look, I don't want to go into, you know, I'm not going to lean heavily into like being too ideological, dogmatic, you know, pushing themes, but there are definite themes in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, although it's not, it's completely irreverent and doesn't take itself seriously, there's, you know, ideas in there I'm actually serious about, you know, exploring.
Yeah, yeah. And that's always the difficult thing with comedy, is that there is a way to get a point across, and you have to be funny, and you have to also make certain that you're not glib in a way that undercuts the initial point, while never forgetting that your job is to make people laugh.
Yeah.
It's tricky. jump through all these hoops for me for this 30-second gag.
And try not to bash people over the heads with it too.
Oh, my God, yeah. Part of the fun of this volume is that it has news reports, album reviews, illustrations, QR codes that lead to fictional TV characters and more. They also play heavily with the font for the band and their names, certain characters like Johnny Platinum, etc. What was the most fun part of it to create? What was the part that you almost had to make sure you have to focus because you could do too much of it because you're enjoying it so much?
You've got a copy that is one remove from probably the final version.
Oh, right. Okay. So
I took the three volumes and sat them next to each other and then sort of cross-pollinated and worked out a bunch of other graphic things I could do to add and sort of just tailor or make sense of some of the chapters as well. Yeah. I just enjoy, like, the world-building aspect of it is just the delight, I guess.
Yep.
I've always, you know, on Twitter at one stage when I had plenty of time, you know, just, you know, doing Photoshops, building up, you know, ridiculous band posters and all the rest, coming up with things that probably like 30 people saw, but with just a bunch of fun. But for this, the opportunity just to build out this world of, you know, and, you know, be pretty much to my whim how everything was presented.
Yeah.
You know, the file photos of like the billionaire Punter Grint, you know, lean into that, you know, the political satire. And I guess I had illustration and the QR codes in mind at the point of maybe when I was thinking about releasing this sort of early last year.
Yep.
Or getting towards that phase. And then you introduced me to Ryan Hughes's XX.
Oh, yeah.
And that sort of emboldened me to go not as far as he goes in terms of like the typographic experiments, but there's moments later in the third volume especially where it's like maybe comparable. Like I'm not as good a graphic designer as him by any means. But sort of, yeah, it gave me more confidence to just go and fuck around and, you know, do fun things with it.
Yeah.
So it's just, as a lapsed, I call myself a lapsed graphic designer. I do still do graphic design, but like I don't think it's what I do entirely.
Right.
But it's super fun to just do that sort of self-indulgent stuff and then see where it where it lands.
Are you the model for most of the men that you then change, you know, like turn them into characters? But the reason I ask is because I don't know if you've ever seen it before, but the David Bowie album Outside, which I think has a real, like, I think it's a really fun album. I think it's got a sense of humor in it that a lot of people kind of miss. But he's written, you know, like a cyberpunk slash parody, you know, detective story that's in it. And he's the basis for all of the different characters from the 6-year-old girl who's abducted to the, you know, the detective and stuff like that. So I was wondering, that's what made me think, not that you were influenced by that, but I was looking at it like going, wait a minute, is that Garth with dreads? You know?
I will say that like maybe Garth circa 2009.
Yeah.
And Johnny Platinum is definitely someone else whose name I won't bring up here, but like a very close friend.
Right.
And you know, that was pretty much, those passages were pretty much written verbatim from memory, really. So,
right.
It was a good party. I've talked about it on here, but
That's funny.
That's sort of the inciting incident, I guess, or the sort of accidental inciting incident. Otherwise, yeah, there are definitely, one thing I did about nine drafts in was I decided to take all the names of actual people who have existed out of the book.
Right. Yep.
Because they're like this, it's set in the Republic of Australia. So there are four previous, there's four Australian presidents, and they were Bob Hawke, John Laws, Peter Brock, and the current one's David Boone.
Right.
I got really scared.
Yep.
And I also decided that like building that world entirely out with like characters that are mine is more, you know, more interesting, I think. And you can sort of get those threads. So a lot of the, a lot of the characters are sort of like modeled on, you know, mainly awful Australian celebrities and media personalities.
Yeah.
I've just hopefully changed the names enough that they don't resemble any person living or dead.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
But especially, yeah, I enjoy the entire process. Like, I like the detail of just like making things seem as though they did exist. Like, you know, just the verisimilitude of like, you know, doing copyright lines and doing all the stupid little bits and pieces that no one will notice.
Yeah.
Making it as authentic as possible.
It's one of the things that I love about putting on stand-up shows is the adding the stuff that nobody notices. And then if anyone does, it's like the best moment of your life.
Yeah. I mean, I've done album cover art. I've done a whole bunch of stuff for it, but like, it was just fun.
Yeah.
And to be honest too, when I started it, I was doing it all on the sly working for a regional newspaper. So I'd write in the morning for them and then I'd just get another Word tab up and write my stuff.
Yeah.
So, no problem.
What a relief. A few more things on the volume without getting too much into it. We bounce back also to 1990 to Johnny, the band Switchback, and the influence of Lefty Tomes found at the ABC. And I'm wondering, what would you be more proud of? Someone reporting on one of these bands as if they were real, or a conservative politician using it as proof that the ABC is ruining the ordinary Australian?
I think I'll take both. I mean, like, if anyone thought these dopey shits were actually real people.
Right.
If it was that convincing, sure. But I can also, you know, former arts minister or the guy who, you know, reduced all the budgets, Paul Fletcher.
Yeah.
Thinking, and by the way, Canberra's ABC is 666.
Yes.
Which is great, which is why I got set there. But yeah, if he thought there was a hellmouth there. That's also fantastic.
It'd be great. I would be quite excited to see one of the bands reported as real. That would be my exciting.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the pitch for the TV version would have included, like, the end of the Twin Peaks Returns. We'd have fictional bands doing songs from the book.
Oh, great, yeah.
Not necessarily every episode, but, yeah, put together bands with people I know and get them to perform as the bands.
Oh, that would be amazing. Genuinely be amazing. And then release a, you know, in a perfect world, you release a limited, you know, blood-splattered vinyl. Yeah,
I mean, I'll tell you what's hard, though, and that's like getting any 40-plus former touring musician to do anything in the timelines you want them to.
Yeah.
So as an adjunct to that, I will say, my friend John Shawk, who plays as a one-man synth experience called Half Majesty, is doing a score for this.
Great.
They're going to start to release in around the time this comes out, I guess. But think more in the sort of direction of Near Dark, Tangerine Dream.
Yeah, great.
Epic prog rock sort of stuff.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing.
And that will come out as an EP via John's Bandcamp. So right. He can, yeah.
We'll put that up at the Facebook page and the Patreon page so people can dig into that as well.
I'm having a meeting with John after this, so we should have some, move it on. Yeah.
Have some info.
It sounds great. Yeah.
That sounds exciting as well. I love that so much. How mapped out is the Homebrew Vampire Bullets universe? Because as of this recording, there's one episode to go of Better Call Saul, and the creators there have been very honest in saying that they can only see a few inches in front of them, which is amazing for the way those stories are concise. But you already have this as three volumes, is that right?
That's correct, yep.
And is that it?
So I mentioned the flow chart, which obviously doesn't look how these three volumes have panned out. And there is volumes 4 to 6 are sitting in the Scrivener app, which is what I use to write, because you can sort of just move chunks around without and sort of just see how they fit within the story without having, you know, Word. Just I can't understand how someone could write anything of length in Word.
Right.
But Scrivener's a really great app for just having each chapter as a separate entity, and you can sort of reshuffle and look at how things work, do color coding and things like that. So there's probably 25,000 words of the next three volumes sitting there. So these first three will come out quarterly from October into April next year.
Yep.
And then I've got a bunch of things that I might turn into prequel novellas. Right.
Yeah.
just shorter pieces that I think are fun. And then work on fleshing out the next three volumes as it happens.
Yeah.
It's been a pretty disrupted couple of years, obviously. So writing hasn't been happening, but sort of getting these into shape has been happening.
And yeah.
Hopefully that sort of will even itself out.
It's part of
kindergarten next year.
Yeah, well, that'll help out.
Yeah.
But part of the writing process is the ebbs and flows of it. And you get on real rolls, and then there's times where everything's just a little bit hard. And they're the parts that you have to push through.
Yeah. So, it's been, I think, getting these into the best shape they can be has been the opportunity this year.
Yeah.
And getting them out there. And, you know, lucky enough to have the time and, you know, resources to make all that work.
Yeah,
and then return to it. There might be. I mean, thinking about it, like, I think I've got a drawing of Ed Von Satan from like 2002 that I might have done.
Yeah,
project, and some, you know, many of the other characters have gone through different iterations from early university, and it's just then mapping out what the story was going to be. And it was, you know, basically taking all my obsessions of, you know, music, the outback, politics. And just marrying everything together with a story that's set around corruption, politics, and the end of the world.
Perfect. Seems like the world caught up to you as well.
And interdimensional warfare, those sorts of things.
All the usuals.
Yep.
The The inner sleeve writings for the albums made me very nostalgic for days when you'd sit down and you'd read the cover while listening to, you know, a new album or something like that. And especially concept albums. Concept albums were the perfect sitting, listening, reading, looking at the artwork experience. Do you have a favorite concept album? Because I have one.
You go first.
Do you want me to go first?
Yep.
I fucking love Kisses the Elder. The album that is pretty much the album that finally sank the first iteration of Kiss. Like, you know, they were already losing fans with their disco-infused...
We're all pretty dynasty. Average musicians. Let's try and do a...
But the concept, it makes me laugh every time I listen to it. It makes me laugh that... you probably remember the cover. It's a... close-up of a door with a door handle and a hand reaching out to knock on it. Like, that was the cover.
Yeah.
And it's, when you listen to it, it's really entertaining.
I'm going to have to go back and give it a listen after this, actually.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying it's good, but I'm saying it's really entertaining.
Mine actually ties into this. About a decade ago, I was starting the anthology that was the precursor to this.
Yeah.
And... there's a guy called a guitarist, animator called Brendan Small, who was doing a TV show called Death Clock on Adult Swim, which was about, funnily, you know, a extremely badly behaved death metal band.
Yep.
And he was writing all the music for it and doing all, and you know, they were, it lasted about a decade, although I don't think there were like that many seasons of it.
Right.
But it was parodying the music industry, really funny. And there's going to be a movie soon, I believe. Yep. And he released an album called Galacticon in 2012 that is not related to Death Clock, but takes his... he's got phenomenal musical skills. And it's sort of a melodic, Queen-inspired death metal intergalactic space opera.
Great.
And it's about a guy called Triton, who's like the greatest hero of the universe, trying to get over his divorce.
Amazing.
Over, you know, 12 amazingly technical songs.
Yeah.
And there's a song called Arena War of the Immortal Masters that actually sort of started the ball rolling on all of this for the initial comic that I drew with the writer Christian Reed.
Yeah.
For that first issue of the anthology. And yes, to this day, great fucking album. Really fun. Yeah. There's a comic that came out that sort of fleshed out the universe as well.
Yeah.
It's not a cool concept album. It's not like going, you know, something from the 70s, but it's definitely a very, very, it inspired a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That sounds like fun as well. You know what you've made me remember is I have a, somewhere in my files, I have my version of a book that I wrote when I was in primary school that is heavily inspired by the Kiss album. And now I'm suddenly thinking, and it's got illustrations, and this will tell you the era. It's got shadings. Remember when you would draw heavily with pencil on a bit of paper and then you'd make these nice shadings? And I can't remember the title of it, but I'm now suddenly thinking,
where is that?
Maybe, I think I know where it is. Even more so, I'm like, maybe I'll record that and have audio producer Sean Allen go nuts and we'll do that. I think it was called something like Zardon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do that for Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted. Tune in each week for the next chapter of Zardon.
Zardon.
Something like that.
I remember creating, like, without knowing, it was actually a Rob Liefeld-inspired comic called Hardware in about 1991.
Yeah.
And then DC released one called Hardware, and I was like,
"That's right,
on the finger on the pulse."
Yeah. By the way, have you just as a little side note, have you seen that guy that takes the Watchmen comic and turns it into Rob Liefeld illustrations and improves it? And it's really funny. Like it's hilarious. Like what he does. I'll share the link with you afterwards.
Yeah, cool.
You think you get the joke after a while and you go, I see what you're doing. And then it pops up on your Twitter feed and you go, nope, still funny. Still really funny what you're doing.
Alan Moore's just like,
I don't know. I feel like he'd probably...
spinning his coffin.
I think he'd probably appreciate this. Yeah.
Do you remember, on that note, Grant Morrison's Doomforce?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, which was the sort of quintessential early 90s piss taker.
So funny. It's really funny. So a few more questions. Which of the albums in the book would you love to hear made into a real product?
It probably says a lot about me, but I had heaps and heaps of fun writing the lyrics to Ed Von Satan's Wilderness Years country albums.
Yeah, great.
Which is sort of inspired, you know, growing up in out there, you know, you'd go to the service station, it'd be like, you know, half a dozen tapes at the Yunta servo, and it would be Kevin Bloody Wilson, Rodney Rude.
Yeah.
There's a guy that's definitely a Dutch guy who was doing awful racist stuff, but it was out there, you know. Yeah, we know who we're talking about. Right. But like all that stuff was in the ether, I guess, at the time. And yeah, I just love the idea of like though that being an album with all the you know, those lyrics. I think that was initially inspired by, I went to a party with an old school friend years and years ago with a group of mates who were in a band, and getting to his backyard, we're like, great, got some beers. What have you got in your stereo, Ash? And he goes to his car, he's like, I've got two tapes. I've got Kevin Bloody Wilson.
Amazing.
And I've got, he's got King Billy Coke Bottle. And we're just like, holy shit, man. This is the breadth of your musical.
Wow.
Just sat there in stunned silence.
He didn't need any more. He was fine.
He had all the CDs, all the tapes. Yeah.
He had all of them. Without giving away too much with what happens in this volume, can you give us an idea of where the next volume will take us?
You are going to get South African mercenaries who have been deployed by the self-help cult, the Arcadia Trust, to retrieve their extremely drug-fucked president.
Yeah.
You're going to get an under-10s fight club.
Yep.
In Outback Australia.
Yep.
And we're going to pay a visit to the Art Gallery of New South Wales.
Great. Finally. All in one volume.
To see a show that's inspired by a lot of the shit that I was seeing at university. Yeah.
Yep. Amazing. I love all of this. And so most importantly, where can people find volume one of Homebrewed Vampire Bullets?
I will be selling this digitally and print on demand, and at this day and age, it doesn't really make any difference. I got my copies of the latest version in 3 days. Right. So they turn them around quickly and really good quality. You can go to passtheamel.com/homebrewed.
Yep.
And there'll be plenty of stuff up there, links, definitely around the time this comes out. There'll also be a special edition cover that's been drawn by the increasingly hard to actually pin down Simon Sherry, who's a fucking amazing graphic designer and illustrator.
Yeah.
Who doesn't take many freelance jobs now because he's too busy making multi-million dollar Kickstarters for fantasy games.
Yep.
So I was very lucky to get Cy.
And that looks great.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said it to me. I was like, oh, that's actually not what we talked about, but that's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a real artist when they kind of disregard what you have to say and just like,
whatever. No, Garth, you're wrong.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, I've got someone doing marketing as well. So if anyone wants me to come on their podcast or do anything, you know, to promote the book, you can contact Anthony at sodaandtelepaths.com.
Yeah.
And he'll sort you out.
Get you out there.
I believe he sent you some presents too, didn't he?
He did. He did. The package was fantastic.
Very helpful.
Yeah.
Nice not doing that stuff.
Well, the package was also, it reminded me of back in the day when I first started doing stand-up, and you would, you know, you wouldn't just send out press releases. You'd send out badges and stuff like to get noticed. So
throwback. Yeah.
Yeah. It made me feel very nostalgic, actually. So, well, it's a really fun read, and I churned through it. And as I said, I was enjoying all the bits and pieces and the way it changes up the storytelling and the reports. And then there's nothing better in a book that you're enjoying and then looking at an advert and going, I'm 99% certain this is bullshit, but this advert looks very much like something that I recognize. So maybe this does exist. So,
hang on a minute.
Yeah, that's always fun. So congratulations on the first volume. And
glad you enjoyed it.
I'm looking forward to this next volume, especially now that it's, you know, going to the Art Gallery of New South Wales.
Art Gallery is, probably the pinnacle. Yeah.
Yep. That's what I've been waiting for. All right.
That's Johnny Platinum going to the art gallery too, so nothing can go wrong.
No, exactly. All right, thanks, Garth.
Cheers, Justin.
Thank you to Garth for hanging out with me today. We already have our next movie for Pass the Ammo worked out, and I'll tell you what it is. It's a movie called Stunt Rock. Yes, that's a real title to a real Aussie movie. You can find it on YouTube. Maybe even just look at the trailer, and I'm not going to tell you anything else about it, but it's bonkers. Like, it's honestly bonkers, and it made me laugh so hard when he suggested it. In the meantime, head to parsiammo.com to order home-brewed vampire bullets, and there's also an extremely limited edition with a cover by the Mad King of Mongrel Punk Illustration, Mr. Simon Sherry. They're only $10 plus shipping for these versions. There's not going to be a digital version of this book, and what I'll do is I'll put the cover up at the Big Squid Facebook page so you can check it out. I'll be back on Thursday with musician Nick Kennedy, and then next week we have our first Space Podyssey of the season with Ben Elwood. So looking forward to getting Ben back onto the podcast. A quick plug for people living in Sydney and Melbourne. I'm bringing my first stand-up show in 3 years to your cities, and I'd love to see you there. My Big Squid listeners get a discounted ticket, so make sure you use the promo code to secure that. Head to bigsquidpod.com. Head to the blog section and you'll find an entry about my live shows that have all the details for your city. And hopefully we'll be able to announce some other cities too. We've been talking to a couple of other places, so hopefully we can tick that off the list as well. Thank you for listening and spending time with me here. It is always appreciated to have your company. Until then.